This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Now listen to this. You are listening to AWOL Radio on CKMS The Sound 100.3 FM in Waterloo. We are also podcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca, and you can find AWOL on the web at peaceculture.org.
On the heels of the release of the OPIRD report, which condemned the strategies and actions of the police during the Toronto G20 protest, the Grand River Media Collective is pleased to present an interview with community organizer, journalist, and author Shayla Keeney, who has a chapter in the recently released book, From Between the Lines Books, Whose Streets? The Toronto G20 and the Challenges of Summit Protest. For more info and analysis on the OPIRD report and to read Shayla's work, visit the Toronto Media Co-op at toronto.mediacoop.ca and dominionpaper.ca.
If you'd like to introduce yourself as you wish and maybe tell us about the recent book launch you helped to host in Sudbury.
So, my name is Shayla Keeney, and I consider myself a community organizer who does independent journalistic work. I was up in Sudbury last weekend. Sudbury is the place where I'm from. It's in occupied Atinamishing Anishinaabeg territory, and it being my hometown, I like to go back and support initiatives that are ongoing there. Currently, the Sudbury Media Co-op Working Group is up and running, and they also held an event with Toronto Media Co-op organizer Jordy Dent. And so we took the opportunity to join the two groups to include the book launch. For the book, Whose Streets? The Toronto G20 and the Challenges of Summit Protest.
Right on. Maybe a quick little, you know, what's going on there in terms of labor, political struggle in Sudbury right now?
Is there? Sure. Sudbury is affectionately the place that I refer to as the place where I got my start. So when I was a young punk, looking around me, I saw organizers who were putting together zines, organizing in anti-racist action, organizing in Food Not Bombs, as well as organizing in community art. So all of these initiatives that brought community together and these expressions that had so much to do with bettering the world around us, that really helped to shape who I am today. So that's what drives me to go back and support in all the ways that I can. The labor context there is interesting. Sudbury has a long history of radical labor struggles. And we just saw a recent strike that ended about a year ago now. And it was a long strike where people were out on the lines for a long time fighting the rollbacks of all the gains that the union had won in years previous. Other than that, there's a group called Sudbury Against War and Occupation that's been ongoing for several years. And there's also a campaign for justice for John Moore. And John Moore is a Native man who was wrongfully convicted of second-degree murder in the 80s. He's from Serpent River First Nations, and in part due to the racism of the legal system, he spent over a decade in jail. And so his case is ongoing, and he's been seeking reviews to have to have exoneration happen. He's already served his time, but he wants to get the conviction off of his record so that he no longer has to meet with a parole officer and so that he has freedom of movement. And he himself attributes much of what he's facing as a result of the racism of the Canadian legal system.
I guess along those same lines with racism in the Canadian legal system, and I guess some of the problems that exist in the policing, get to your chapter in the G20 book, Whose Streets? It was called Women Resist, Police Repress, Stories of Gendered Violence at the Toronto G20. And to me, reading it, it felt very personal and very strong. You obviously are very passionate about what you were writing on, and it showed. Can you tell me about the chapter a bit and tell our listeners about maybe why you wrote it and a little summary of what it's about?
Sure. I was working with the Alternative Media Center in Toronto during the G20, and when a friend of mine who is also working at the AMC, a colleague, was arrested, throttled at the neck, thrown into a police van, and threatened with gang rape. At that moment, I recognized very viscerally the fact that the policing was taking on a gendered element. Mm. As people were being released from prison, women were saying that they had been systematically strip searched, whereas men had different stories, and some of them didn't even have their pockets searched.
You can attest to that.
There we go. So that contrast demonstrated that gendered violence was occurring in a way that was designed to disempower and traumatize certain people who were there to demonstrate against the G20. I then sought out interviews with people who identify as women and as genderqueer to collect these stories, to be able to say, look, this is actually a systematic issue. This is something that's going on and deserves being paid attention to. The approach that I took with this research was informed quite a bit by Joy James, who wrote Resisting State Violence. Hmm. And Joy James writes that the policing gaze is informed by a racialized as well as classed bias. And I would add to that it's also informed by a gendered bias. So what that means is that the way policing gets carried out, in what areas it gets carried out, and who experiences the brunt of policing more consistently is determined by the socio-political factors that characterize your life. If you're living, in a shelter, you're going to see the police a lot more often than if you're living in a suburb,
right?
Unless you have private security roaming your suburb, and you can pretty much be rest assured that the private security is not there to police you if you're living in the suburb, that they're there to police people who are coming elsewhere with the assumption that that because of your class you're not a threat.
Mm.
So what I was getting at there is that the fact that gender was used as a tool of violence against demonstrators at the G20 is not isolated to the G20. And the interviews that I conducted with the participants ranged from people who are long-term seasoned activists who have been to several summit demonstrations and who are expecting that kind of crackdown to some degree, to people where, this was their first demonstration and were feeling rather naive after the fact because of what they had suffered.
Mm.
And the latter group of people walked away feeling like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that the police would do that to me. Like, I thought the cops were the good guys.
Mm.
But the reality of the situation is that these tools don't come out of nowhere. That if you're a sex worker, gendered violence occurs all the time, You're like, if you're being arrested for sex work, there's a high chance that you will also be sexually assaulted sometime during the arrest, with the assumption being that you are assaultable.
Hmm.
Something else that I think that I want to say there is that there was the systematization of strip searches in the detention center, and that in itself probably came from above, it somewhere in this complex command structure that was organized specifically for the G20. But certain other things, like calling women certain gendered insults, or calling genderqueer or trans people certain insults while in the detention center, those things occurred within a context of impunity, where over and over again, it was described in the interviews that this was like a hazing for frat boys, that like this kind of context was set up where people could bully the people inside using all the tools of racism and sexism and transphobia and homophobia that were at their disposal to make mm-hmm. people feel like less than human, like less than they were.
No, I mean, you've already pointed to that this is, you know, systemic. It's not necessarily a few bad apples at the G20 itself, but it was decided that that's what was going to go on in the detention center by you know, a group of people, but also in the daily kind of day-to-day struggle, it's the same systemic problems that exist. I can only assume. Were you getting those same sort of stories like from people that experienced things at the G20 the same way that they've experienced it on a daily occurrence outside of a protest situation?
One participant described it this way, that the brilliance of an oppressive force is that it has to do very little and can re-stimulate very much. That all it has to do to someone who's been oppressed in the past is remind them that they've been oppressed in the past and stick them there. And so within the detention center, when women were being forced to strip down naked and bend over in front of strangers and hear soundtracks of women crying and asking over again why, these things were calling up past experiences of sexual trauma. They were triggering experiences, and they were designed to be so.
At
least in the city, I feel I can do things. It's not always pretty, but something draws me here. It's a feeling I can be. Brown purple and most all miserable. There's light in the darkest field, deflected by saltwater tea.
You know what? We're not breaking any laws here. We're having a fucking dance party.
The behavior of some members of this demonstration is causing a breach of the peace. It has been determined that reasonable grounds to arrest exist, and that force may be used.
I'm watching you, watching me, watching you, watching me.
take us. Just keep fucking dancing.
On the heels of the release of the OPIRD report, which condemned the strategies and actions of the police during the Toronto G20 protests, the Grand River Media Collective is pleased to present an interview with community organizer, journalist, and author Shayla Keeney, who has a chapter in the recently released book from Between the Lines Books, Whose Streets? The Toronto G20 and the Challenges of Summit Protest. For more info and analysis on the OPIRD report and to read Shayla's work, visit the Toronto Media Co-op at toronto.mediacoop.ca and dominionpaper.ca.
Another thing that you brought up quite and discussed in your chapter, and I guess comes through this design, is the Miami model, and that model of policing protest. Do you want to talk about that a little bit and how it applied in Toronto?
Sure. So the Miami model is named after the anti-WTO protests in Miami in 2003, where it is upheld by certain pillars. And each of these pillars was observable at the G20. One was information gathering and surveillance. One was information wars, like, for example, in the newspaper, creating an us versus them, creating a cops versus anarchists sort of dialogue. In the weeks leading up to the demonstrations. Another one was a militarization of command structure. So you can think of the integrated security unit and that was formed by members of the RCMP and the OPP, as well as CSIS, and the like complicated command structure that existed underneath the ISU, where people couldn't really trace accountability back up the ladder. And then the fourth being the excessive use of police force on the street. Each of these came into play in Toronto. And in some ways, Toronto was an experiment of the Miami model, where it was a refining of the structure in the sense of the fence being built around the like fortress of downtown Toronto, similar to what we saw in 2001 in Quebec City. The renting of the film studio that was then converted to an elaborate holding cell that was designed to hold 1,000 people.
And then they filled it up?
And then filled it up. And what I think is interesting here is that we're seeing an internationalization of a policing model for summit demonstrations that is then used every time these world leaders get together for the sake of this discourse of national security, right? These become internationally protected persons, and so this model gets transposed from country to country. Forming an international policing model,
where they're refining it each time as well.
Where they're refining it each time, that's right. And it's also putting into practice what kind of policing is necessary in order to keep capitalism running in the way that it's running, and to allow for the proliferation of these types of organizations to make the decisions that are going to affect everybody all over the world while keeping people out.
Right. And I guess in Toronto it was all over the place. The information gathering, obviously, they had, I'm trying to think of the number of cameras they put up and left up throughout the city. All the searches, all the ID checks, the, you know, ID checking and searching everybody trying to enter a park, because they just surrounded the park against, you know, charter and court rulings that they're not allowed to just surround a park. But they're kind of using these techniques that they've developed. I know in COP, the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit, they were using the exact same models and trying to cut off the ends of the march and segregate people away within marches, keep it, you know, and just arrest everybody en masse. And definitely have just seen the progression of it since, you know, Miami, or I guess probably before that, but I guess it's called the Miami model for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, we saw it in Quebec City. And in part, I think it was a response to Seattle, where, like, the Seattle came out of nowhere. The police were not expecting the type of popular uprising that they saw there.
Right.
In Quebec City, however, the police were definitely prepared. So it could very well be called the Quebec model.
Right.
You know, you're right. The name matters very little. The effect is the same.
Right.
That it is an international policing model that's being practiced over and over again.
And it's definitely a total policing model where they're just going after, you know, the internet to kind of control communication flow.
Mm-hmm.
They're going into people's emails. They're going to people's meetings, the private and the open meetings, and just trying
mm-hmm.
to get a full, kind of full tactical understanding, I guess, before the protests even happen.
Absolutely, and we could talk about each of these pillars of the Miami model and talk about how they came into play. That was part of what I was doing with my research and my writing was to demonstrate that the way that this policing model plays out necessarily has a gendered element to it, whether or not that's recognized in the official literature mm. of what the Miami model means. But one thing that came out was in terms of the information wars and the media that came out in advance of the G20, a lot of it had to do with the militarization of police technology. So the riot gear, the infamous sound cannons
mm-hmm.
made huge headlines before the G20, and there was even a parade.
Yeah.
It was like a parade press conference where the cops were parading all of their new technology as though it were a fashion show. And what they were trying to do there was try to scare the crap out of anybody who would even think about going to protest the G20. Mm. And the part that I think that's important to point out there is that tens of thousands of people showed up anyway, and that's bravery.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a statement that sings the praises of the people who went, who believed that their convictions were stronger than the fear of the repression that they would face.
Well said. Now, you said you were involved in the Alternative Media Center
mm-hmm.
at the mobilization, at the convergence, the Toronto G20 convergence. What was your experience in the media center, and why did you feel it was important to be involved in getting the movement narratives out there during the convergence?
The creation of independent media and alternative media is fundamentally important to any movement for social change. The media that we create shapes our understanding and our experiences and allows the production of materials that will inform our analysis and growth. So the fact that the Alternative Media Center was there to serve as a central platform where people could tweet in updates about arrests that were ongoing, and where people could get information about their friends, as well as serve as a reflection on what happened the day before. It was solid. The machinery of the AMC, the Alternative Media Center, worked really well. Every day there were broadsheets that were being produced that gave mm-hmm. updates and analysis of what happened the day before. And I think that's where the case of Imotimi Zorbo,
mm-hmm.
That information was able to be spread about what it means when the police will target somebody and injure them based on their disabilities. And it also operates as a central focal point where people can get literally on the same page about what's going on in the streets, where you could look at the broadsheet and be like, yo, look, this isn't, the police are not our friends here.
Right.
They're actually here to control us, and this is proof. similarly, this book, Whose Streets, does a lot to analyze where we've come from, how we built the movement against, in opposition to the G20, as well as inform us on what our experiences were there and where we're going. So as a piece of independent work itself, the book serves to contribute to that discourse. Yeah, I guess I just want to say that we can't underestimate the importance of communication on a larger scale. You know, discussions are important, and so is the research and the analysis that comes out of doing focused alternative media work.
You know, you got a lot out of it. You learned. You enjoyed yourself during the AMC experience.
I couldn't say I enjoyed myself. I think there was probably there was at least a handful of us where we were like all standing outside the AMC chain smoking, and we're like. One person was like, yeah, I quit smoking a year ago. And then the next person was like, yeah, I quit smoking 6 months ago. And I was like, I haven't had a cigarette in like 3 months. And we were all sitting there being like, oh man, like we are stressed out. And it was hard to sit there and like get the updates of our friends being, you know, surrounded, punched in the face by police, getting their equipment seized. You know, this person needs court support here, and this happening here, and it was an important space to be in, to connect to other people who saw the value in the work the way I did, but it was also harrowing. I mean, I don't know what to say about it. I was glad that we didn't get raided, and I was expecting a raid.
Mm-hmm.
But you know.
Fair enough. Yeah. Well, there's a whole chapter on the AMC in the Whose Streets book
that you wrote.
Little self plug.
And if you want a better analysis of what the AMC is like, I suggest you turn to chapter, what is it, chapter 10?
I forget which chapter it is.
What kind of organizing or resistance keeps you inspired and keeps you doing this?
I'm recognizing the utmost importance of intergenerational learning in our movements. Sometimes I wonder if we're doing a good enough job at passing on our skills from person to person. And I see such a cry in the up-and-coming generations to change the world for the better. And I think it's really, really important that we make sure that they have all of the skills and all of the tools that they need and that we've developed in order for them to carry their work on. I think we need to build capacity. And when I see this happening, when I see people doing really solid person-to-person skills training, and when I see people take that to the next step of actually organizing, that's what gives me hope, and that's what inspires me. Because I think we will succeed. I think we are winning. Sometimes it's hard to see that, but we're getting there.
So is there any campaigns in particular you're working on right now, or anything you'd just like to add in closing today?
Currently, I'm working on prisoner support, specifically around the G20s. There are many charges still pending. Some people are facing jail time currently. So it's important for me to keep those people in my mind and in my heart and in the forefront of my actions. I'm also currently working on gender justice out of Guelph, and we're looking at reproductive justice campaigns, and as well as other anti-oppression work that's going to be happening out of our community. And I just want to say, I guess, give a shout out to all those working in independent media, such as yourself, because this work is of vital importance, and keep up the fight.
And we can check out some of your writings on the Toronto Media Co-op and the Dominion websites?
Yep.
Awesome, we will. Well, thanks a lot.